Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is Donald Trump trying to accomplish by resuming nuclear testing? And what impact will this decision have on nuclear non-proliferation? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Since the mid-1990s, nuclear states have implemented a comprehensive test ban of nuclear weapons. India and Pakistan broke that ban in 1998 and for a short time faced economic sanctions. North Korea has apparently broken this ban and has been treated as an isolated pariah. But the ban is under threat. Recently, Donald Trump announced that he intends to order the U.S. to test nuclear weapons. He claimed that Russia and China have already broken the ban, but that claim appears to be rather specious. So what would be the impact of the U.S. resuming nuclear testing? What does this mean for international commitments to both what we call horizontal proliferation, that's countries that currently are not nuclear, not developing nuclear weapons, and vertical proliferation, countries that do have nuclear weapons committing to reducing and possibly eliminating their nuclear stockpiles? Might it give a greater impetus towards the banning of the prohibition of nuclear weapons and shifting the norms, the expectations, the treaty obligations about nuclear weapons? So on today's show, we're going to take stock in the current status of nuclear weapons, the impact of this U.S. announcement, and explore this issue in greater detail, an issue I'd like to note is an existential threat to the planet. Our guests are Joe Cirincione. He is a national security analyst and author with over 40 years experience, the author of the books Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats. And nowadays, you can find his most recent writings on his Substack that's entitled Strategy and History. Wayne Glass is Professor Emeritus in the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California. He's a former Senior Defense Policy Advisor to Senator Jeff Bingaman on the Senate Armed Services Committee and has worked extensively with nuclear weapons, nuclear arms policies in the United States. And Ira Helfand, MD, is a member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN's, International Steering Committee. He's a co-founder and the past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. And he's co-authored PSR's influential report, Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion at Risk. Thank you all so much for joining us on such an important issue. And Joe Cirincione, I'll start with you. Donald Trump has announced an intention to start nuclear testing. What's the impact of that? And what can we make of his claim that he's simply responding to Russia and China testing nuclear weapons?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. Thank you very much for having me on the show, Doug. And I'm honored to be on with a group of experts like this. Number one, the impact would be to start a dangerous new phase of this nuclear arms race that we're in. All nine of the nuclear armed countries are now building new nuclear weapons, some expanding their arsenals. But no one has renewed nuclear testing, something that all the nuclear armed states stopped doing it about in the 1990s, except for North Korea, which, as you note, tested six weapons ending in 2017, and they're considered a pariah nation for breaking this international norm. So why is Trump doing this? Well, number one is we don't know. We just don't know, because his statements were so confusing and so garbled and filled with, well, not facts, let's put it that way. So it may have been just a sort of a verbal gaffe. Something caught his eye, he responded to it, he just tossing this off. It may have been a little more strategic than that. He made the statement right as he was about to walk into a meeting with China's President Xi. So it may have been kind of a boss move, trying to a muscle flex. You know, I could start nuclear testing. It could be something like that. The worst scenario is that he may have been convinced by some of the hardliners around him, particularly those from the Heritage Foundation, who have been championing the idea of returning to nuclear testing and wrote this into their Project 2025, a script that Trump has largely been implementing. If that is true, if he's giving in to the nuclear hawks, that he wants to start testing nuclear weapons again for the purpose of making brand new types of nuclear weapons, the only real reason you would need to test, well, then we could be off to a nuclear test race. Because if we test, Russia's already said they're going to test. China, which has only conducted 45 tests, a fraction of the 1,054 tests that we've conducted, China would certainly follow. India and Pakistan would certainly follow. North Korea might get into the mix, and there you go. That's a new phase of the arms race. We could see nuclear explosions shaking the earth for the first time in many years.
And Wayne Glass, this ban on comprehensive on nuclear tests is a treaty. U.S. didn't actually ratify that treaty, but it's held, even though the U.S. hasn't ratified that. So what's that status? And it seems like the U.S. has always been the biggest risk to break the ban, right?
You're taking me back to the old days, Doug. I was in the Senate when the Senate when the president put the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty before the Senate for ratification vote. And the experts and the senators were all concerned about or curious about why would we begin testing at that point? Because our nuclear stockpile had been tested literally hundreds, if not thousands, of times, and the degree of confidence in the ability for those weapons to do what they were supposed to do when they were supposed to do was quite high. And in the eyes of the experts, there was no need to test to raise the confidence level that we could actually use those weapons if we were called on to do so. Nonetheless, the Senate voted against ratification of the treaty. And I suggest the dark side of this conversation is that there are billions, tens of billions of dollars that are invested in the nuclear modernization program for the United States arsenal that includes the weapons themselves as well as their delivery vehicles. That's a lot of money on the table. I think that's really what the argument or the nubs of the argument back in the 90s was basically. We've got to make sure that our nuclear arsenal is what we think it is, and we have sufficient confidence that it'll work if we need to have it work. Scientists suggest that it was okay. We didn't need to do that. And in fact, if we resume testing, not only would it be expensive, but it was essentially a green light for anybody else, our peers and the nuclear wannabes, to begin their own nuclear thing. It's taken the lid off of the nuclear race in technological ways. It was a tough loss in 96, I think it was. Joe, maybe you remember the date of the vote. But and so here we are again. Hello, welcome back. What's the change in the arsenal? Are we any less confident in it so many years later, having spent tens of billions of dollars in the stockpile stewardship program? If we are less confident, then we've wasted a lot of money, not to mention, the international repercussions of taking the lid off of the arms race. There's a lot of other arguments that pertain here. Maybe we'll get into them in the discussion, but that's from the Senate point of view. That's what I saw, and that's what I see. Where we are at the moment, it's very discouraging, I have to say.
Now, you highlight two really interesting, important questions. One is the cost of testing and how much of our resources have we put in to our nuclear weapon stockpile? And secondly, what the impact this has on non-nuclear states wanting to develop nuclear weapons and, certainly charges, how committed are we to controlling nuclear weapons? But there's a third sort of huge cost that I certainly want to highlight here. And Ira Helfand, I want to bring you in. And that's the threat of the humanitarian crisis, the fact that nuclear weapons are, it's more than just something that costs a lot of money and has a power component. It's literally an existential threat to the planet. And so, how much is this testing reminding us, or the potential of this test reminding us, Ira, that this really is a much more significant threat than sometimes we've treated it?
Well, thanks, Doug. The threat to resume testing has actually had one beneficial effect, which is that it is putting this issue before the public again. And that's terribly important because I think the biggest problem we face today with regards to nuclear weapons is the fact that by and large, we're ignoring them. You know, experts like William Perry tell us we're closer to nuclear war than we've ever been. And we walk around as though this problem didn't exist. And this threat to resume testing, whatever it actually was supposed to mean, has had the beneficial effect of putting this issue on the table again and making a lot of people think about the fact that nuclear weapons exist and that they're dangerous and we need to do something about that. Of course, the bigger impact probably is to essentially destabilize the world. I don't think that the United States was planning to test before Trump's speech. The Secretary of Energy has said that. And it's not clear if they actually are planning to resume explosive nuclear testing now. This may, as Joe pointed out before, be just simply, you know, a misspeak on Trump's part. It would not be the first time. But the fact that he would make a statement like this, it creates enormous uncertainty about what the United States is going to do. Were we actually to resume explosive nuclear testing, it would be catastrophic for arms control and would greatly increase the danger of us stumbling into a nuclear conflict. You know, when we conduct an explosive nuclear test, sometimes it's done as a way of getting further information about the warheads we're developing, but sometimes it's done purely for political reasons. You know, the best example of that was the Soviet test of the Tsar Bomba, their enormous nuclear device, a 50 megaton explosion, something that was clearly not deliverable as a weapon, and was set off basically to scare the world. That may be the motivation behind the U.S. push, as promoted by the Heritage Foundation, to resume nuclear testing, just further saber rattling. But even the threat to do that has that saber rattling aspect. And we saw that right away. The Russians responded, well, if you test, we're going to test. And what we need to be doing is recognizing that these weapons pose an intolerable risk to the survival of our species, to the safety of our planet, and they must be eliminated. And this is a move very much in the wrong direction.
So, Joe, I, in reading and, you know, preparing for this, and I've been asked this, you know, certainly by my own students, Russia was conducting some sort of like nuclear adjacent testing, wasn't it? What was Russia actually testing?
Okay, so this is why he might have just been confused. I mean, I have to tell you, it does appear from what he said and what he wrote on his Truth Social posting that he really doesn't understand what he's talking about. He said, because of other countries' testing programs, I've instructed the Department of War to start testing on nuclear weapons on an equal basis. That process will begin immediately. Okay, several things are wrong with that. No other country is testing nuclear weapons, exploding them. No country is exploding nuclear testing. Second, the Department of War, what we know is the Department of Defense, doesn't conduct the tests of U.S. nuclear weapons. That's a job for the Department of Energy. And third, you can't begin this immediately. As I say, we stopped testing these weapons in 1992, that the Nevada test site is not equipped to start testing. The Department of Energy estimates it will take approximately 3 years and several hundred million dollars just to open the test site up again. So what is he talking about? Okay, he may have been confused by the Russian test several weeks ago of two nuclear weapons delivery vehicles, the platforms that carry the weapon. But these missiles that he tested, one was a long-range cruise missile, the other was a long-range underwater drone or an underwater torpedo, both powered by these experimental little nuclear engines that they tacked onto the back of them. But they're not an explosive weapon. There was no warhead on them. Is that what he means? It's unclear. There is another possibility, and that is the United States and Russia, and we believe China, conduct something that's called subcritical tests. That is, we test the components of the weapon except for the fissile material, the highly enriched uranium or the plutonium that represents the core of the bomb. That's the thing that goes bang. Everything else is just conventional explosives that sort of are compressing that material close enough together to start a critical chain reaction. We do those too, but it's not a nuclear explosion. It's a conventional explosive just to make sure that the mechanisms around it, everything else but the nuclear material, is working. Maybe he meant that. Some on the right argue that Russia is actually generating a small nuclear explosive with those tests. But if so, it's so small, nobody's detected it. So it could be some combination of all this that in Donald Trump's confused and muddled and semi-informed brain all yields what he said. Now, as far as we know, nothing has actually been done yet, but we are fearful that there's a process that's been set in motion that could yield to preparations for this test. As I say, that would take some time. Vladimir Putin, in response to Trump's statement, told his own scientists to begin preparing to resume nuclear tests. So we have everybody inching up to the start line right now. It's still a dangerous phase, but it's not critical yet.
Wayne, I know that this is part of what's broadly referred to as the sort of the modernization drive. And one of the things Joe is suggesting is that nuclear modernization, first of all, the U.S. has been doing this, Russia has been doing this, apparently China has been doing this without testing nuclear weapons. And you don't need to test the nuclear weapons to modernize your nuclear stockpile. First of all, I mean, is that accurate? And or at some point, is there going to need to be some sort of testing? And secondly, it seems like they're spending a lot of money on nuclear modernization, even, you know, with the test ban, right?
The modernization program, as I mentioned, it covers more than simply the warheads themselves. It includes the infrastructure that tests and builds the components, the testing of it, the laboratory work. It's a very extensive infrastructure behind nuclear weapons that's so expensive, and it's so part of the nuclear modernization program. Not just the weapons themselves, but there's a lot more that goes with it, which is why it's so expensive. So my concern is, okay, so we're spending a lot of money on nuclear modernization. What's the value added to that? What are we doing? Are we designing new nuclear weapons that have gone where no man has dared go before? Or is it to increase our confidence that the ones we already have are going to work? The idea underlying the nuclear arsenal, at least from the American strategic point of view to this date, has been nuclear deterrence. Let's build the strongest inventory that we can so that we'll deter the other guy from using his nuclear weapons. So in the process of that nuclear arms race, it wasn't only quantitative, it was qualitative. And so we went from the big boomers to the little ones and all levels in between, with the notion that there might be a scenario of nuclear escalation from the small to the massive, or vice versa. Well, if we don't have nuclear deterrence today, what will improve it? New stuff? More stuff? And that's when I keep shaking my head. I'm going, you know, I just don't. The only thing I can really figure out that's driving this whole train is the money that flows through the increase in spending on research and development, testing and production and deployment in the nuclear modernization program. Because at the end of the day, I'm not sure our deterrent force is any better than it was 20 years ago, ultimately. Mm. So I think it's important to keep the context and the strategy of a nuclear arsenal in the first place in mind when we're talking about testing. Okay. If we're going to make new nuclear weapons, what's the value added? If we're going to make more nuclear weapons or refurbish the old ones, what's the value added? And mm-hmm. I think if you measure that in terms of deterrence, I just see a lot of money going down the hole in terms of our national security expenditures. There are other ways to spend money on national security than nuclear modernization, not to mention national priorities of other expenses, such as education, healthcare, transportation, environment, all those other claimants to our national treasures. Poor choice, in my view, to invest more money into the nuclear infrastructure. One last comment, if I may, Doug, and that's I come from a nuclear family. My dad was a nuclear tester when I grew up. Very bright guy, liked him a lot. He was a wonderful guy. Well, where did he go to work? He went to work for a nuclear laboratory. What else could he have done with his skills? A lot of other things, but the paycheck was coming from the nuclear laboratory. So my point is that there's an opportunity cost at the personal level of national abilities, and people are choosing to go where the money will hire them. And so you feed more money into the nuclear modernization program. You take more talent away from other needs in our society. And I think those are penny wise and pound foolish ways to spend money.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the state of nuclear weapons, the announcement that Donald Trump made that the U.S. intends to return to nuclear testing, and the impact that has. Our guests today are Joe Cirincione, national security analyst with a wonderful Substack called Strategy and History, Wayne Glass, professor emeritus from the University of Southern California, and Ira Helfand of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and Physicians for Social Responsibility. And Ira, I know ICANN obviously has had this campaign to promote going beyond nuclear nonproliferation to nuclear prohibition. And one of the motivations that authors have suggested, one of the real strengths of this is right now the horizontal nonproliferation, countries that, trying to convince countries that are not nuclear not to go nuclear, the enforcement of that rests with the nuclear states. And there's a bit of an inherent hypocrisy that's tied to that. And so part of the motivation with the TPNW, the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, is to maybe empower non-nuclear states to have more of an impact. Where I'm going with the question then is, Wayne has pointed out that if the U.S. starts testing nuclear weapons, that really undermines horizontal nonproliferation. The question is, where should our priorities be? And how much, if our priority is nuclear nonproliferation, do we need to make sure that we're empowering those who are going to convince other states not to develop nuclear weapons to not develop them?
I think the possibility, the threat of horizontal proliferation, spreading nuclear weapons to other states, is real and important. But really, that's not, in my mind, the big issue. And I don't think that's really the big issue as far as ICANN is concerned. Our worry is about the weapons in the hands of the nine countries that already have them. It will be worse if more countries develop nuclear weapons. But the real threat to human civilization doesn't come from the one or two weapons that the that the Iranians might develop. It comes from the 5,000 warheads in the U.S. and Russian arsenals. And that is the issue that needs to be addressed. It's not enough to freeze the status quo and prevent further proliferation. The status quo is not, as we are sometimes led to believe, a stable situation. We're not here today because this system works. We're not here because we've known what we were doing for the last 80 years, because we've had perfect, military doctrine, wise leaders, infallible technology. We're here, according to former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, because we lucked out. It was luck that prevented nuclear war. And I think that is the situation. We have been skating on thin ice for a very long time. We've been incredibly lucky. And as we all know, no one stays lucky forever. So the real challenge is not just to keep other countries from getting nuclear weapons, but to figure out how to get the countries which have nuclear weapons to understand that whatever benefit they think they're deriving from having these nuclear forces is way offset by the risk they are running of blowing up the whole world. And we're told sometimes that it's unrealistic to talk about the elimination of nuclear weapons. I think what's really unrealistic is to think that we can maintain arsenals of tens of thousands of nuclear warheads into the indefinite future and expect that nothing's going to go wrong. It will. If we have if nuclear weapons are maintained, it's not a question of if they're going to be used. It is only a question of when. And so there's a real imperative to figure out how we get rid of these weapons. That's the question we need to be asking. Not should we get rid of them or not, but how do we get rid of them? And that requires some further negotiation. The TPNW provides a roadmap for the elimination of these weapons, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. But there are details that need to be worked out amongst the nuclear armed states. The verification procedures need to be worked out in detail. The timetable for eliminating the weapons needs to be worked out in detail. And that's the work that really the international community should be addressing. And the idea behind the TPNW process was to provide a vehicle whereby the countries which don't have nuclear weapons and which seem to understand the risk better than the countries that do, to give those countries a way of pressuring nuclear armed states not prevent further proliferation, but to get the states which already have the nuclear weapons to honor the agreements they have signed in the past with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and eliminate their nuclear arsenals, something which they can do and which they should do.
And so actually, Ira, I want to follow up then, because a lot of times analysis of the TPNW will argue that it's a repudiation of the nuclear nonproliferation, the treaty itself and the norms behind nuclear nonproliferation. But you don't see it necessarily as a repudiation as much as an actual extension of what nuclear nonproliferation was intended to do and kind of pushing towards a more stable goal of getting rid of nuclear weapons. Is that a fair description?
Absolutely. This is not a repudiation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The Non-Proliferation Treaty under Article 6 charges all signatories to negotiate in good faith the elimination of nuclear weapons. That's exactly what the countries that came together in the TPNW process did. And it's what the rest of the countries, the United States, the other nuclear armed states, and their allies need to do as well. The people who are threatening the Non-Proliferation Treaty are those who are shirking their responsibilities under Article 6. This, you spoke of hypocrisy. I think the term that's often used now is nuclear apartheid, where nine countries reserve the right to have nuclear weapons and the rest of the world isn't supposed to have them. That's not what the NPT says. The NPT says no one should have them. No country should develop nuclear weapons, and the countries which already have them agreed in that treaty to negotiate their elimination, and they have failed to carry out those responsibilities ever since the treaty went into effect. The TPNW is trying to correct that. It's trying to enforce the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
When we come back, it seems that Donald Trump does not understand either nuclear testing or the basics about nuclear weapons. Does this lack of understanding undermine U.S. policy for non-proliferation? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The United States is unique in that a single person controls the decision to use nuclear weapons. Could the international response to the U.S.'s announcement of resuming nuclear testing change the command structure? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests today are Joe Cirincione. He's a national security analyst, authored several books, including a Substack called Strategy and History. Wayne Glass is professor emeritus in the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California and has a long history working on nuclear policy issues, particularly on Capitol Hill and the Department of Defense of the United States. And Ira Helfand is a member of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, their steering committee, and also a co-founder and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Joe, you've described President Trump as being less than knowledgeable and perhaps less than stable on these questions. But the U.S. is actually fairly unique in giving one person the capability to launch a nuclear war. Is this question, the testing, are we ready to revisit this question and at least have greater safeguards in place for things like, you know, who has the authority to launch a nuclear war and greater nuclear safeguards?
Yeah. Thank you, Doug. You know, there are many things wrong with our current nuclear posture, and there's a long list of them. We touched on some of them. You know, why are we spending $100 billion every year on nuclear weapons? You're right off the top. Why are we living in a state of existence where any one of these nuclear armed countries could set off a war that would destroy all of human civilization within hours? Why do we put up with that? But of all those, there's one in particular that I've always felt was one of the greatest failures of the Democrats when they were in charge of the executive branch for not fixing, and they should have fixed this decades ago, and that is the U.S. policy to give sole authority to the President of the United States to launch nuclear weapons whenever he wants, for whatever reason he wants. People don't believe us when we tell them this, that it's up to the president. He doesn't have to check with anybody. There is a military officer, and if you saw the wonderful new Netflix film that's out now, A House of Dynamite, you see that military officer who's carrying what they call the nuclear football, a big suitcase with the launch codes and launch plans in that suitcase, that he has to follow the president of the United States 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He can never be more than a minute away. When the president gets in an elevator, the officer gets in the elevator with him. And the reason is that we have, as Ira mentioned, 5,000 nuclear weapons, 1,700 of them are ready to launch on hair trigger alert. They're ready to launch at any minute. We estimate it takes about 4 minutes for them to launch once the president gives an order. And to give that order, all he has to do is summon that military officer over to him, ask for the codes, pick up the phone, identify that he's the president of the United States to the general or maybe colonel who's running the combat operations center at any one time and give the order. At that point, it goes. He doesn't have to consult with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs or the Secretary of Defense or the Congress or the Supreme Court. He just goes. No one can stop that order, even if it is totally nuts. There used to be the belief that the military officers would not obey an illegal order, say an out of the blue order to launch military weapons. Well, in real time, we are seeing the U.S. Navy repeatedly obey illegal orders to shoot, to blow up Venezuelan boats that are carrying what is alleged to be drugs. Now, that is not legal under international law, under military, our U.S. military law, and yet we are doing it. So we're seeing military officers follow illegal orders. This is the great worry. Are there other countries with this kind of crazy system? Most other countries require some kind of consultations, some kind of group decision, two people, three people in them. However, what we've seen over the last 15 years is a very disturbing development. Of the 9 nuclear armed countries, 7 of them now have authoritarian leaders. So we're used to China, Russia, and North Korea being authoritarian regimes who acquired nuclear weapons, but we now have nuclear armed states that are acquiring authoritarian regimes: India, Pakistan, Israel, the United States. Now, these regimes aren't as consolidated as those in Russia, China, North Korea, but they have strongmen leaders who push people around, who flout their own laws. I don't think in any of those countries, if the leader, whether it's Modi or Netanyahu or Donald Trump, were to give the order to fire, I don't think there's a person that would resist that order. The order would go and we'd be off to Armageddon.
And Wayne, then, I know that the discourse on nuclear weapons shifted, you know, post 9/11, when so much of the fear was on nuclear safeguard questions and what would happen if a terrorist organization got a hold of a nuclear weapon. Joe's highlighting the fact, I mean, that's still a nightmare scenario, but that could actually, there's other nightmare scenarios that don't even involve that. But with that in mind, do you know, or do you have any estimates how much money we're spending just on ensuring safeguarding these weapons so they don't fall in the hands of terror groups? And how much confidence do you have that those safeguards are flawless? It's almost impossible to see flawless, but, you know, are going to continue to be effective.
I wish I could give you a dollar figure. That's so far beyond my pay grade. There's so many commas and zeros there that I can't even begin to think of it, because we can always think of, and we did certainly during the 90s, Joe, how many different ways the bad guys could get their hands on either a weapon itself or the technology or the expertise or the materials that one could accumulate to put together one Hiroshima-sized nuclear device. And we had all those scenarios of, you know, floating a device into a harbor or putting it on a paddle truck and driving it into Manhattan and calling the president. How do you prevent that? Well, we had a lot of programs to try to prevent that from happening, that scenario of the nuclear threat coming from non-state actors. A lot of money being spent on that. And of course, that didn't mean that the state actors were nothing to worry about. So we've got this huge nuclear nuclear threat vehicle with lots of holes in the hull that we were constantly trying to stick our fingers in, and all those holes in the dike. And each finger in the dike is a very expensive one. There's no way, in my opinion, that we will ever be able to, with high confidence, ensure that the nuclear threat goes away by sticking fingers in dikes. It's not going to happen. I agree entirely that any solution is going to be on verifiable monitoring of the nuclear weapons arsenals of the nuclear states, as well as the infrastructure that goes behind it. That's the only solution. Otherwise, we'll worry ourselves into oblivion until further notice. So I can't give you a dollar figure, Doug, but I can say it's very expensive. The track of $1 trillion plus on spending on our nuclear weapons program is maybe we're into the 2 trillions. I'm not sure what the number is these days, but it's massive. And it shows no signs of letting up. There are people who profit by this, and that's their motive. So it's like anything in America. If you want to sell a product, you got to scare the wee out of somebody in order to justify spending big bucks. And we're right smack in the middle of that paradigm right now.
Can I just weigh in on that?
You want to jump in, right?
Yeah, Wayne, that's exactly right. I mean, all of us here have been through these nuclear debates for some time, various phases of the nuclear arms race. And very often they were driven by ideology. It's always people like us who were worried that this war was going to start and we had to get rid of these nuclear weapons as fast as we can. There were others who were convinced that America has to build up its nuclear arsenal in order to stop the bad guys from getting an advantage on us. But I would say right now, ideology plays at best a secondary role. We spend $100 billion a year on nuclear weapons, plus another $30 billion a year on missile defense, plus a new $25 billion bonus to start the new Golden Dome plan that Donald Trump has, his revival of Ronald Reagan's Star Wars plan. So that's about $150 billion. That is a big market. There is a lot of money to be made there. And if you think these companies like Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman or others are doing this because they're patriotic or out of the goodness of their heart, you should take a look at their profit margins. They're huge. These people are making a fortune out of building nuclear weapons. And as Doug says, in order to do that, you've got to create the market for it. You've got to scare people into believing this is absolutely essential for the security of the United States. It's exactly the opposite. Nuclear weapons are the greatest threat humanity faces, not our best security against disaster.
Can I just add a factoid to this conversation? Because it's a moment that I'll never forget in my time in the Senate. I had a long conversation with the general in charge of America's Strategic Command in Omaha, Nebraska. And I asked him the question. I said, how many, if it came to it, how many nuclear weapons delivered on the Russia, the former Soviet Union, would bring that society to a standstill? His answer was, oh, maybe 100, maybe. That was at a time when 6,000 were online and ready to go. Now it's, what, 1,600, Joe? I think you said the number. Okay, so 100 versus 1,600? You get it? It's la-la land. When it comes to what do we need to protect ourselves or to maintain nuclear deterrence, it's la la land. It has no roots in logic. And so there's got to be another reason for that. That's what I'm talking about. I see these other reasons clear as day in retrospect. And it's so alarming because the needs of our society are so wide and deep. And we, quote, can't afford them.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about the announcement that the U.S. may be resuming nuclear testing that came from President Trump, the impact on the existence of nuclear weapons, on nuclear nonproliferation, and the possibility of prohibiting nuclear weapons. Our guests today are Joe Cerencione. He has a Substack called Strategy and History, Wayne Glass from the University of Southern California, and Ira Helfand of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons and Physicians for Social Responsibility. And Ira, whenever I present, I teach this in classes, and the idea of prohibiting nuclear weapons, I'm always told, well, I mean, that's idealistic. It's unrealistic. I wrestle with this. Why is it unrealistic to get rid of nuclear weapons when the other WMD, biological and chemical weapons, are banned? What is it about nuclear weapons that makes them different than chemical or biological weapons in the way that we think about whether or not we should just ban them rather than try to control them?
I don't think it is unrealistic to think about getting rid of nuclear weapons. In fact, I think it's something that would be relatively easy to do. I'm not sure that the analogy with chemical and biological weapons is the best one, because even though they're banned, they haven't been eliminated. There are still chemical weapons. They've been used just recently as the civil war in Syria in the last decade. Banning them is useful. It helps to create the global norm against them. But we need to go beyond that. We need to actually eliminate these weapons. And that's especially true of nuclear weapons, because that's also one of the arguments that gets raised in opposition to eliminating them. What if somebody cheats? What if somebody holds on to one weapon? I think we need to approach this from the point of view of what is the benefit you get from having nuclear weapons and what's the risk? And the risk is really the overriding concern here. As Wayne just pointed out, it was the assessment of the Pentagon that if you could deliver 100 nuclear warheads to Russia, to the Soviet Union, you could end that society's functioning. We have data now that shows that if 250 nuclear warheads, relatively small ones, are detonated on cities, the resulting climate disruption and the famine that will result from that climate disruption could kill a quarter of the human race in 2 years. So the danger of maintaining these arsenals could not be greater. And we need to move to eliminate them as quickly as we possibly can. What's unrealistic is to think, as I said before, that you can keep these weapons and expect that nothing's ever going to go wrong. It's only unrealistic because our leaders don't want to do it. That's a problem. These weapons clearly do make the countries that have them more powerful, but strength, power, is not the same as safety. In fact, in this case, there's a real discord there. Nuclear weapons make countries that have them strong, but they threaten their safety. While I think the economic motivation of the companies that make nuclear weapons is a key force in driving this whole process, what enables them to get away with it is the persistent belief that deterrence works, that there's something stable about the current regime, that having more strength equals more security. And we need to help people understand that that isn't true. And it's a little bit difficult because in much of human history, it probably was true that if you had stronger weapons than your enemy, you were safer. The problem is if your own weapons will kill you if they're used, and that is the case with nuclear weapons. These are suicide bombs, and suicide bombs do not make you safer. So a lot of the work we need to do is educating the leadership of our country and other countries that have weapons, and educating the population about these dangers. And to do that, we need a grassroots movement that reaches out and creates the same understanding that did exist back in the 1980s. Here in the U.S., we have such a movement, the Back from the Brink campaign, which has grown dramatically in the last 2 years and is poised, I think, to replicate the success of the Freeze movement in terms of educating the population about the need to eliminate these weapons. We need to develop that campaign here. We need to try to encourage similar movements in other countries that have nuclear weapons where that kind of political organizing is possible. And we need to really reject this idea that we are the people who are being unrealistic, because we're not. We are the realists here. We're either going to get rid of these weapons or they're going to get rid of us.
Joe, the U.S. has been adamant that countries should not develop nuclear weapons and gone so far as the U.S. bombed Iranian sites to try to ensure that Iran did not develop nuclear weapons. And this is a president that walked away from a deal that was a pretty good deal, actually, I think quite a good one, to try to convince Iran not to develop nuclear weapons. How much is this announcement really undermining, you know, in particular vis-a-vis Iran, undermining a global campaign to convince the Iranians not to develop nuclear weapons?
As long as the major powers show that they value their nuclear weapons and that they believe that these are essential to their national security, other countries are naturally going to think that they might need to get nuclear weapons themselves. Zach, I remember Mohammed El-Baradei, the former Secretary General of the IAEA, told me when I was interviewing him at one of our Carnegie Endowment National Nonproliferation Conferences, as long as the big boys keep their toys, others are going to want them too. And that's exactly right. So when you say things like this, when a country's spending this much of our national treasure on these weapons, when we keep saying they're essential to us, when we say that we're going to match what any other country's doing, well, of course, other countries are going to want to have them. The only solution to this is not building up your own arsenal. It's what John F. Kennedy talked about in 1960 when he was debating Richard Nixon to be president of the United States. There was only four countries in the world that had nuclear weapons back then. And he said, if we don't do something, we're going to have not four nuclear armed countries, but 15, 20, 25 countries. And a lot of the countries he meant at that time were our allies. Japan was considering getting them. Then West Germany was considering. Australia, Norway, Finland, Switzerland had a nuclear weapons program. And so the solution to that wasn't to try to outrace them, which it was to do diplomacy. He couldn't live to see the results of his efforts, but Lyndon Johnson successfully negotiated the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and then Richard Nixon signed it into law. This was a bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, working together to establish the framework that Ira and Wayne have been talking about, this international nonproliferation regime where the countries that have nuclear weapons promise to negotiate their reduction and eventual elimination, and those countries that don't have nuclear weapons promise never to get them. Well, if you start taking that apart, if people start thinking, well, the countries with nuclear weapons are never going to get rid of them, well, then the bargain starts to fray. Or if they lose confidence in the leadership of those countries, then even allies are going to reconsider their non-nuclear status. And that's what's happening now with some of our NATO allies. They no longer trust that Donald Trump will protect them, will commit U.S. military force and diplomatic force to their protection. So you hear countries like Germany, like Finland, like South Korea and Japan starting to discuss getting their own independent nuclear arsenal. I expect that kind of discussion to grow unless U.S. shifts policy. Unfortunately, under Donald Trump, I think the chance of him shifting policy are quite small. So we're in for a rough few years here where things, I believe, are going to get worse before they get better. And even if the Democrats win the White House in 28, there's no guarantee that they're going to do anything about it. Joe Biden didn't. Joe Biden had no nuclear policy. He didn't cancel a single one of the programs that Trump started. He didn't reduce the nuclear spending. He increased it. He didn't negotiate any new arms control treaties, even though he probably was the most informed arms control president ever elected due to his years on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So we're in for a rough road. And I think Ira's right. We do have to build up public awareness of it. That's why I'm so excited by this new film, A House of Dynamite. I hope people get to see it on Netflix, because it crystallizes the nuclear risks that hang over our heads, as John F. Kennedy said, like a nuclear sword of Damocles hanging by the slenderest of threads. It can happen at any moment, and we should be devoting as much effort as we can to eliminating this threat, as Ira says, before it eliminates us.
Wayne, I suspect I know the answer to this question. Do you share the pessimism about the future of the future of the nonproliferation regime, future of nuclear weapons? Because this announcement just kind of reminded me that we aren't any closer to nuclear disarmament, despite what seemed to be at least some promise in the 90s. We move in the wrong direction?
Boy, you know, I can't tell you, Doug, how disappointed I am with what's happened since Joe and I and a bunch of fifth column guys in Washington were working really hard to solve this problem together.
Yeah, why didn't they listen to us, Wayne?
I don't know. It would have been over by now. But, you know, and Ira, I appreciate what you have to say, and it fits with what Joe had to say about the president's statement. It's quite clear to me, and I spent a lot of time hanging around politicians, that in this particular case, the president really didn't have a firm grasp on what he was saying. And so the idealistic part of me says, oh, if we could just get our leaders to get smart about all this, we wouldn't be saying these stupid things. But Joe, your point about President Biden and his lack of activity during his administration to try to fix things is a great disappointment, because I know Joe Biden did know a lot of stuff about this. So education at the leader level is certainly missing. But even if we manage to do better, It's no guarantee that you're going to get smart thinking out of the mouths of high-level politicians. So education is important, and I think it's really important at the grassroots level. I'd feel a lot more comfortable if education was more pervasive at the leadership level in the executive and legislative branch around the country. That would be a good thing. And then the last point here is that there's a long history of nuclear mistakes. You may have the best decision makers, but you've got to have people that handle the weapons and package them and transport them and keep them safe 24/7. That's not a guarantee. It's a long trail of mistakes that this country has made and other countries have made since the advent of nuclear weapons being deployed around the planet. And there could be a mistake. And once the mistake happens, the balloon may go up. And if the balloon may go up, then we really don't know. There's a lot of theologians who believe that there's a nuclear escalation ladder that will be carefully orchestrated until somebody says, let's stop. I don't have that kind of view of things. Once the stopper comes off the bottle, I'm not sure that any sort of slow, reasoned decision-making on behalf of our political leaders is going to win the day. I've seen too many cases where decisions are made under political pressure that aren't the right ones. And when you're talking nuclear weapons, nuclear explosions and so forth, the risk is extreme because it's not just a flashpoint. It could be the whole enchilada. If we don't understand that, our leaders don't understand that, then we're really playing with fire, nuclear fire.
Martin Sherwin's recent book, scarily titled Gambling with Armageddon, seems to make those same points. Ira, I'm going to give you the last word. If we can't trust the political leadership to make these choices, it really seems like we need to turn to a grassroots movement where people are demanding that if we don't trust them, you know, with the ownership of these nuclear weapons, and it is literally an existential crisis, you know, life on this planet, we have to get rid of them. So the grassroots movement to think differently about nuclear weapons seems awfully salient at this point.
I think it is. I think it's really the key thing that's been missing over the last 10 or 15 years. We've tried to change government policy in an incremental sort of way within the Beltway. We've tried to get the Obama administration to adopt a no first use policy. We've talked about taking weapons off air trigger alert. None of that has moved forward. I think it requires several things. The leadership does need to understand, and frankly, in most cases, I think they don't really understand the risk that they're running. They may understand it in a very abstract sort of way, but they don't get it in their gut about how dangerous this is. But in addition to educating the leadership of the nuclear armed states, we need to create political pressure for them to take action, and we need to create the space where they think that they can take that action and not get kneecapped by the nuclear industry. So the answer to all of that, I think, is a very broad educational campaign to create the kind of understanding of the nuclear danger that we did successfully create back in the 1980s. And I think that's important to bear in mind because the task seems somewhat daunting, but we have done this once before. In 1983, the U.S. put Pershing missiles in Europe with a stated goal of being able to fight and win a nuclear war in Europe, a totally insane proposition, but formal U.S. policy at the time. We were at the brink of nuclear war, and we thought, I think most of us, that we were not going to survive that period. But there was a huge movement in response to that reckless behavior that was demanding a different policy. And I think much to our shock, less than 2 years after the deployment of those missiles, less than 2 years after the two incidents later that year when we almost had a nuclear war in September and again in November, Gorbachev and Reagan sat down and said nuclear war can never be won and must never be fought. And that profound change in policy was so stunning at the time that I think most of us didn't think it was real. When I heard that pronouncement, I thought this was just a bunch of rhetoric. They haven't really changed, but they had. And I think the lesson we need to take away from that is that if we are able to both educate the leaders, and we were able to speak directly with both Gorbachev and Reagan, we being physicians from the physicians movement, if we're able to speak directly to the leadership and explain to them what is going to happen, what the medical consequences, the humanitarian impact of nuclear war will be, and if we can also mobilize enough public opinion so that they feel compelled and permitted to take the right action, I think that's the way forward. No guarantee this will succeed, but this is the only way this is going to end well. You asked Wayne, I think, before whether he shared a certain pessimism about the current situation. I'm certainly frightened by the current situation, but I have some guarded optimism that we can deal with it. Again, because we did do this successfully in the 1980s. We were able to build that movement. And I'm very encouraged by the rapid growth of the Back from the Brink campaign over the last 2 or 3 years, by the development now of a new student organization, Students for Nuclear Disarmament, which has spread now to 25 campuses around the country. This movement needs to be much stronger than it is currently, but the foundation has been laid to build the kind of movement we need to bring about fundamental change in U.S. nuclear policy. And we just need to continue forward with this work and hope for the best.
I think that's a great point to end this conversation. Our guests today have been Joe Cirincione. He's a national security analyst and author of, with over 40 years experience, author of numerous books, including Nuclear Nightmares, Securing the World Before It's Too Late, Bomb Scare, The History and Future of Nuclear Weapons, and Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats. And now you can read his most recent work on the Substack that's entitled Strategy and History. Wayne Glass, he's professor emeritus, professor of the practice emeritus at the School of International Relations at the University of Southern California, former senior defense policy advisor to Senator Jeff Bingaman on the Armed Services Committee, and worked extensively on American nuclear weapons policies throughout his career. And Ira Helfand, MD. He is a member of the International Committee to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICANN's International Steering Committee, co-founder and past president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the co-author of PSR's very influential reports, Nuclear Famine, 2 Billion at Risk. I want to thank you all for sharing your time, your expertise, and also your lifetime commitment to working on these issues. I really appreciate being able to have this conversation with you all.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.